Hacking, data, and identity theft are causing devastating problems. Globex Data is the solution for privacy and security in the digital world. Switzerland has the world's strictest privacy laws, and Globex Data's Swiss-hosted platform is outside of big tech with no data mining. Globex Data is now launching in the USA, offering email and messaging privacy and security to all Americans. Globex Data Limited, stock trading symbol SWISF. Web address, globexdatagroup.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and it's a pleasure to welcome the author, Roya Hakakian. Her new book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya is an immigrant to America from a country of my grandfather and grandmother's birth. Once upon a time, Persia, and many versions before that, but now known as Iran. And her story gives us an understanding of what it is to arrive not only from Iran, but from around the world to modern America. We begin the storytelling with a day that Roya chronicles in her book in an ethnic food store somewhere in New York, and she's shopping, and she observes a couple from Iran who are newly arrived. I think 6 weeks and 4 days is the detail that emerges. And they're puzzling over a piece of meat in the frozen meat counter because they can't read the label. And Roya comes up to them to offer her help. Roya, congratulations. And a very good evening to you, and thank you for this. This young couple you're observing, you go to help them, and you immediately fall into their language, your language, from Iran. They seem apparently grateful. You note that the wife is clutching her handbag. Why? What does this tell you? Good evening to you, Roya.
Good evening, John. I'm delighted to be back on your show and in conversation with you. This is exactly as you describe. It's a new couple who have just arrived, and they feel so insecure in this new country that they don't believe that they can trust to leave any of their valuables at home. So the wife keeps carrying the passports with her in her handbag. And so she constantly clutches it. They carry all the cash that they've brought with them in the same handbag with them wherever they go. And this is just a symbol of how unsettled and insecure they feel about being where they are.
And in the exchange, you help them with the label. But the surprising part is what happens next. They want to know how long you've been here and where you're from. And then the husband, I puzzle. His reaction to you, suddenly he seeks a position in which you don't know what you're talking about. What to make of this, Roya? What was happening in that exchange?
Well, it's really, I'm really moved by the fact that of all the scenes that you could have picked from the book, this is what you chose. But it was, in fact, one of the first nuggets that I decided would land in the book before there was a book, because I did have an encounter like this with two newly arrived immigrants who looked at me, asked me how long I have been in America. And when I told them that I had been here for, you know, over 30 years, they turned somewhat hostile. And I have thought about why that was. And I think I took the hostility somewhat personally, you know, at that moment, but it was nothing personal. Because I think as new immigrants, people come believing that they're here temporarily. However, this place has, you know, miraculous gifts for the newly arrived. Most of us want to be back where we were born, you know, where we have family, where we have mastery of the culture, tradition, language. And so as much as we're grateful to be in America, we still hope to be back in the place where our ancestors are buried. And I think what I felt, which manifested itself as hostility from that new immigrant, was a sense that oh, you are the one who has stayed here that long, but we, on the other hand, aren't you. We won't turn into you. We are here for just a few years, and we will definitely be back.
And there was a sense that you didn't know what you were talking about because you hadn't been home, because things have changed, and therefore you weren't really them anymore. You were that. Were you being demoted in front of them? Is that what I was hearing?
That's exactly right. I mean, they, as soon as they heard that I had been in America for over 30 years, they started telling me that I was no longer, a true, genuine compatriot of theirs. I was something else. I'd been outside of the country for so long that I didn't know what things looked like. I didn't know how places had changed. I didn't know, how people spoke on the streets anymore, how the colloquial language had transformed. And it was as if they were telling me that they were distancing themselves from me, and by putting me outside of their territory of their own intimacy and familiarity. And again, I think it was an effort on their part to make themselves secure in the idea that they would never turn like me, and they would never have to live in America for as long as I've lived in America, that they would be able to go back.
Let's get in the time machine and go back 30 years before that conversation. Yeah. You're arriving at the airport. Yeah. You arrive to take a line of non-citizens. You talk about having that magic green passport that allows you to go to your own line and right through to enter into America. I've walked that same carte blanche passport, observing the long line behind me, because everybody in America has a parent or a grandparent or an ancestor who arrived in that long line. What were your thoughts in that long line, getting ready to be interviewed for arriving in America?
Well, I was terrified and devastated and exhausted all at the same time. I was terrified because, it was sort of a passage into a rite of passage moment. I mean, it wasn't about growing up. It was about being granted entry. It was do or die. I feared what we might be asked, for months and months before. Various people, while we were refugees in Europe, had prepared us for those questions. And the more they prepared us, the more insecure I became about, getting it wrong or answering whatever it was that they were asking the wrong way, or forgetting the details, or not remembering, something that I should say. So I was terrified. I was terrified of screwing up. I was exhausted because it had been not just the long plane ride, but it had been just a long year that my mother and I had spent as refugees in Europe. I was also, there was also a thrill because, I could see very vividly, even from the get-go, from just the, looking at the terminal, that we were in a vastly different place than I had ever been.
You arrive, you manage the transportation from the airport to New York, and now we come to a scene that is truly amazing. You lose your mother on the subway. I understand that you didn't mean to. You take her by the hand and you lead her to the right train, but they've switched trains on you. What were your thoughts when your mother disappeared? Would you ever see her again? And we know you recovered her. We know she was brought home by a wonderful MTA worker, but what were your thoughts while she was gone?
Well, it was incredibly frustrating because my mother and I had, by virtue of being, two refugees in Europe, we had been together, inseparable, for a whole year. In fact, we shared a bed when we were in Vienna, waiting for our asylum applications to be processed. So, I had been with her all along. And what was very ironic about that year was that our roles had completely reversed, that I had become the mother to my mother, and my mother had become my child. She relied on me to figure things out. She relied on me to know the things that I didn't know as much as she didn't, but somehow she trusted or she had confidence that I could figure them out better than she did. So I was responsible to figure out how the subway system worked in America. I was responsible to speak English when both of us didn't know how to speak English. So I'm glad that she had so much trust in me, because in fact, it helped me kind of catapult myself and take, you know, all sorts of leaps of faith, which eventually worked out for me.
There's a happy ending to this. Mom is brought back by a wonderful African-American MTA worker, which is your introduction, I believe, into the many aspects of America that are not obvious when you're just reading about this. In fact, the woman who brought her back not only was being generous, it described it as her job. It was routine. It was, you know, this is what I do. It was a wonderful moment. It was a payoff for a scene in which you lost Mom, Roya. You lost her. How were you going to explain to your family? One day she just disappeared. But Roya is going to learn English. And when we come back, we're going to English as Second Language class with Roya Hakakian. The new book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Roya Hakakian, the author Roya Hakakian, her new book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya has arrived in America 30 years hence, and she is in an English second language class. There are many of them. It's part of her introduction to America, the groups that are helping her, because there are many NGOs who facilitate this transformation. And yet she realizes in the class are all these other people from all over the world. Roy, I got the sense that you all of a sudden woke up to the fact that your experiences were not unique, that everybody was having the same experience, but you were in a world, it was more populated than the United Nations General Assembly, is the sense I got.
Exactly. I mean, years later, I got on a boat at Disneyland and went into Small World, and I thought, I've been here before. It was the ESL class that I attended when I first came. You know, it was truly the most multi-ethnic experience, multi-racial place that I had ever been to. And it was staggering. And it was America, because nowhere else in the world such a thing could have happened, where I would be seated next to people from Venezuela, people from Gambia, people from, you know, you name it. And, you know, we were 20 people, each one of us had come from a different country. And it was a reassuring experience, because we were all out of it. We were all without English. We were all lost in America. So that was reassuring. But it was also frustrating, too, because, you know, we could look at each other and realize how much help we needed and how, in fact, lost we were.
I accuse you of being literary, because you're now about to take us to an internal dialogue that happens in this class and afterwards. And you call it in one word, self-estan. What are you learning, Roya, in self-estan? What are all those people in those English second language classes learning about America?
Well, we are learning that unlike the places where most of us came from, where, you know, the value within the society was placed upon families and communities, that America, on the other hand, placed the greatest value and considered the individual as the main unit of the society. That is one of the most staggering experiences for any immigrant arriving in America, I believe. Because, you know, we come from communal countries, most of us, I should say. And then to come to America to realize that so much in this country revolves around the self is a completely, not simply new, but an evolutionary experience that we all have to catch up with and comprehend.
Right. You take a phrase that was routine. It's almost the banter of America when mm-hmm. people depart from each other or they're going around not going to see each other for a few days, not just going to the store, but not for a few days. The phrase is take care of yourself. How did you, how do new immigrants hear that?
Well, the first time, the father of a friend of mine heard this, and he was from Iran, turned around and said, why are they telling me to take care of myself? Is something bad going to happen? Well, that's because in most other countries, when you part from people, you say, you know, may God be with you or may God protect you. It's not, you're left to the hands of some greater divine power. But in America, you are told that you're supposed to tend to yourself. You're supposed to, you know, make sure that things go well for you. And that's a vastly different way of not just being, but also expecting you to be in a society. It's telling you, reminding you that your first and foremost job is to tend to yourself, which is not, you know, the culture in where I came from or where most immigrants come from. We're supposed to tend to families. We're supposed to be selfless. We're supposed to put others above ourselves. We're supposed to care about the leader more than ourselves, the religion, you know, our religious leaders, our communal leaders, our tribal leaders more than ourselves. And to think that now we've come to a country where the self is supposed to be placed above all else requires a different brain, a different way of seeing life and seeing ourselves too.
You find it in education everywhere routinely because our education system is not based on what you evidence was the education system in Iran memorizing. Our education system is based upon responding in a fashion that is consistent with your experience, not what the book says, but your experience. And that surprises you. I believe there's a day when a physician turns to you and asks you for your opinion in medical training, and you're shocked by it. You're almost speechless because it's your opinion he wants to hear.
Yes, that's actually a friend of mine who was a woman who had been in medical school in Iran. And she was a star student, and yet she had, until that day, never been in a ground rounds with other doctors where she had been asked what her opinion was. And it was a rude awakening for her because she came to me afterwards and said, I've been in America doing this, you know, 3-month exchange student training at their hospitals. It isn't that I have learned something scientific that I didn't know about medicine or the practice of medicine in the past, but there is something I have experienced here that I never knew before. And that is the fact that other people cared to know what I thought. People older than me, people who were men, people who had more experience practicing medicine, wanted to know what I thought. And she had clearly been changed as a result of that simple question, what do you think? And it was the moment that it was that question that made her decide to stay in America because she thought she could never go back to a place where people expected her to keep silent anymore. She wanted to be in a place where her opinion was solicited.
The book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya Hakakian is the author. When we come back, 9/11. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, having a conversation with the author, the literary author, Roya Hakakian. She has a new book. It says it's a story both of her life and the life of other immigrants around her. in these last decades, entitled A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. 9/11, Roya's native land, my grandparents' native land, is Iran. 9/11 was a day in which Iran was back in the story. It's never really been out of the story since 1979 for the United States, but back in the story, and a scene in Roya's book, a man living in Queens who has a view of the skyline of Manhattan, as you do in buildings in Queens, high-rises in Queens. Mm-hmm. And the skyline can resemble Tehran. He's lonely mm-hmm. for his native city. And yet mm-hmm. the day of the attack, he sees, well, at some point he hears the news and then he can see the burning. What is that moment for this man, Roya?
Well, the man was my dad, and I saw something in him that day that changed my view of immigrants in America altogether. My father used to sit on the balcony, look at the skyline, and write poems about how much he missed Iran and how much he missed Tehran. And I believed all along that he had not bonded with this country, that as much as, you know, he was grateful about being admitted here, he still longed to return, and he didn't have the feelings he had for Iran, for America. And that day, as soon as he saw the smoke in the sky and saw on the news that a terrible thing had happened, he put his shoes on. He had macular degeneration, so he could hardly see. But he reached for his cane and he made his way out of the apartment. When I asked him where he was going, he said he'll be right back. He didn't respond. And then he came back with the biggest American flag he had been able to find at the store around the corner. And he hung the flag from the railings of the balcony. Now, I have to tell you that I had known my father all my life, and he had never been one for flags. He had never been, you know, someone who associated himself with such symbolic things. And yet I saw that he found in himself something he even didn't know existed in him, which was a deep love and appreciation for America, which that day of disaster revealed to him.
You cite the possibility that this will happen repeatedly to immigrants over the centuries, because as a nation of immigrants, there's a moment when you become something that is no longer in the old country. It's both in the old country and now this is your country. You mm-hmm. cite the possibility of a natural disaster. I believe the example you use is the San Francisco earthquake of 1905. You cite the example of Pearl Harbor, and mm-hmm. both instances. In San Francisco, it was an opportunity for the Chinese Americans, the Chinese immigrants, to become Americans. And in Pearl Harbor, it was an opportunity for the Japanese Americans, who were brutalized by the regime, but to transform themselves into patriotic Americans. And many of them served in the U.S. military. So that mm-hmm. possibility was always there for immigrants as well. I want to take you then into the experience of the diaspora, because mm-hmm. it is not all positive. You write, mm-hmm. there are moments when you're in the, quote, firm grip of loneliness. Why, Roya, mm-hmm. given all the positives you find in your new land, what is the loneliness about?
Well, because we have come to self-esteem, right? I mean, there are beautiful cars, you know, the weather is, you know, the air is clean, you know, the electricity is not interrupted for the most part. You know, things work here. And that's really significant for most of us who come from places where the infrastructure keeps failing. And yet, what keeps persisting is loneliness, because America places so much value on the individual, and because placing so much value on the individual makes us turn in to ourselves rather than our families and communities for the most part.
And that creates loneliness. I puzzle also, poetry is dominant in the cultures of Central Asia. I've never traveled to Iran, and for reasons that are obvious. I did fly over it once, and I looked down upon Lake Urmia, and that was a thrill, Roya. I mean, you know, I saw where my grandparents were born. Yes. And maybe someday, you understand, maybe. But I've been in Central Asia where poetry, poets are celebrated hundreds of years later. We don't do that. I mean, we have our poets, but it's not a commonplace topic. Does that make you lonely for your land, that poetry is not extolled here, that we have, well, as you write, we're planners, we're not poets.
Precisely. I mean, but you have to understand that it wasn't, that poetry was not just about literature, or, you know, it was an exercise as a form of art. It was also a way for people to connect. Something that I found, you know, as soon as my parents were here in America, they started doing, before they were doing anything else, was that they had organized what they knew they had always done with their friends back in Iran. They had poetry parties, poetry gatherings, regularly. So, you know, they would get together on Sunday nights at someone's home. There would be some form of dinner, and they would sit around and recite poetry. And, you know, every time I mention that to my, you know, whenever my American friends ask what my parents were doing, you know, on Sunday evening, and if I told them that they were with their friends at a poetry party, people were stunned. But that was sort of a routine way of people finding an excuse to communicate and to get together. And poetry was just the conduit for all that.
Coming to America and becoming an American citizen, naturalized, is the ambition. You take us to an historical incident, the arrival of a Persian, this is 1870s, and introduced to the President of the United States, Ulysses Grant, and granted citizenship. What did that Persian man, that world traveler, see in America that made him want to be an American citizen in 1875?
Well, I think he is sort of the first Iranian to bring us all here to America. His name was Haj Sayyah, which means, you know, the traveler. And he had just left home in search of something. I'm not sure he knew himself what it was that he was searching for. But he had gone everywhere. He had learned several languages. He had been received by the Pope and by various kings throughout Europe. And by the time he came to America, he had seen the world, known what there was, and then found in America something that he fell in love with. And he coined a term for that find. He coined a term, human rights, which had never existed in Persian language before. So he's the person who introduces the term into Persian. And so when Grant asks him, why is it that you love America so much above every other place that you've been to? He says to him, because you have human rights. Because you recognize the value of the individual and the rights of the individual more than any other place I've ever been to. And so President Grant asked him, so what is it that you wish to have in America from me? What can I do for you? And he says, because of this, I want to become an American citizen. And President Grant arranges for him to become a U.S. citizen, and he becomes the first Iranian American.
That's December 1874. The citizenship is in May of 1875. And because life is not a screenplay, there's a twist in ending here.
Yes.
The visitor, who is now an American citizen, returns to America, but America wants to maintain good diplomatic relations with Persia, with the Ottoman Empire then in charge. And so because the man has been an outlaw back home by speaking out for human rights, the American government deports him. Deports him because he's not one of us, though he has citizenship.
Right. So what happens is that he meets with President Grant. He becomes a citizen. Then he's sort of restless, as he had always been in his life, and he goes back to Iran. He doesn't know why he goes back to Iran, but that's who he has become. He's he's happy to be in America because he sees what there is here. But then after a while being here, you know, just like all diaspora, he also has a longing that he can fulfill about his home country. So he falls into that trap and he goes back to Iran. And as soon as he goes back to Iran, they find out that he, you know, he keeps talking about, you know, the beauty of America and the values that he has learned and the things that he thinks that Iranians need to have. And he pisses people off and gets himself arrested and chained and shackled in a prison. And while he's in this Iranian prison, he finds a moment to get away and he runs, and takes shelter in what would later become the first American embassy in Tehran. And the interim ambassador takes him in, then sends a cable to Washington and says, I have this fellow here, Haj Sayyah, in my custody. I've given him sanctuary. He has good naturalization papers and it seems that he truly is an American. What should I do with him? And that's when Washington writes back and tells the interim ambassador, well, he is indeed an American, but don't forget that he's also a Muslim and he is not worth marring or upsetting relations with Iran. So cut him loose whenever you have to. He's not worth the trouble of keeping if it's going to upset our relations with Iran, which is a very sad thing to find when I read it.
Diplomacy, when we come back, yeah. Diplomacy, yeah. In the 21st century. The book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya Hakakian is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Conversation with Roya Hakakian, the author. Her new book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious, Diplomacy. The U.S. and Iran have been at odds, and it looks like a war, it talks like a war, it acts like a war. It's a war since 1979, since the revolution. And Roya has written, many have written, of the outrages perpetrated by the mullahs, by the regime in Tehran. And yet, maintaining diplomatic relations is the ambition of states that are at odds. Geopolitics insists upon it. The puzzle for the immigrant is what to make of the news. You want to be an American citizen. Your ambition is to be naturalized American citizen. And yet in the news all the time is the threat of war with your native land. Roya writes the wonderful image, you're a twilight citizen. You're neither this nor that. You're somewhere in between, especially while you're waiting to be naturalized. Roya, it is easy to condemn Iran for its human rights, as it was easy in 1875. It's easy now. At the same time, the U.S. seeks diplomatic relations, seeks all the time Iran in the news. How does the immigrant hear tension between his adopted land, America, and his native land? It doesn't have to be Iran. It could be Venezuela, any number of countries that go through bad patches. How do you hear it? And what do you do about the negative? What do you do about the prejudice around you?
Well, it's probably one of the most complex, if not the most complex, experiences that we as immigrants encounter in America. And I say complex because we ourselves are clearly critical of the countries we come from, or we wouldn't be here. But at the same time, we don't want to be seen as the same as our governments, or we wouldn't be here if we agreed with our governments. So I think teasing out the notion that if we are here, it's primarily, or at least most of us are here, because we objected to those governments. And yet people around us, you know, often associate us with those very governments that we've run away from. And therefore subject us to hostilities and and various, you know, feelings that, you know, negative feelings that they have towards those governments. And I think part of that is because, you know, there hasn't been enough coverage, or at least textured coverage, nuanced coverage, where we have aired a very a multi-chromatic, multicolored view of the diaspora, Iranian diaspora, North Korean diaspora, Venezuelan diaspora, where we have been able to air a lot of these complexities in the media.
And when you're asked where you're from, early mm-hmm. on, this was mm-hmm. a moment where you paused. And mm-hmm. do you come up with a euphemism for where you're from? Do you say Central Asia? Mm-hmm. Do you say the city Isfahan? How do you deal with your concern that Iran is in the news and often very negative?
Well, I think a lot of my compatriots have figured out another formulation. They call themselves Persian Americans, which is true, right?
Yes.
We come from a land that used to be called Persia. Your grandparents were from Persia because, you know, Iran wasn't named Iran until much later. But, you know, and that brings to mind, I don't know, cats, beautiful cats and glorious rugs. But I never choose to do that because I feel like I should be able to allow other people to take me on for the flaws of the Iranian government, for its crimes and whatever else that concerns people. And I should be able to enter into conversation with people who are curious or are worried and allow the debate to take place. So I call myself Iranian American and therefore expose myself to a lot of negative feelings that people may have.
Your children, do mm-hmm. they want you to speak English? Do they respond to you in Persian? My mother, remember, spoke Assyrian, and she didn't want us to respond in Assyrian, though we could when we were small children. How is it today? Uh-huh. That was 60 years, 70 years ago. How is it today, Roya?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When they were much, much younger, when they were in kindergarten, they hated when I spoke Persian to them, especially in front of their friends, because they would appear like outcasts. They would appear different from their peers, which is what they hated to do. But these days they're teenagers and they happen to be in among communities of peers who are all hyphenated Americans. You know, they two of their friends were over yesterday. One of them was Korean American and spoke Korean at home, and another one was Indian American and they spoke Hindu at home too. So now it's fashionable. And they welcome the notion that they have just one extra language under their wing to boast of with their friends.
And going home, you mm-hmm. become a naturalized American citizen. That gives you citizenship. It remains dangerous to travel to Iran. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But going home, do you mm-hmm. think about it before your day is done here on the planet, to go home and reflect about all this?
I don't have dreams of returning to live in Iran ever again.
Right.
None of the places I knew, and none of the people I knew are there anymore. You know, my school was taken over. You know, the house of my childhood, was demolished and turned into an apartment building. So none of those things, especially the Jewish community that I was born and raised in, has really dwindled. So there isn't much that was similar to what I knew. But I do believe that all of us as human beings have this desire to return to our places of birth, or at least have access to our places of birth, because I think something that I didn't think would be significant was to have a connection to the land where your ancestors are buried.
Right.
And I think that somehow is a very important human desire to be able to have, access to the country where your, grandparents and parents are buried.
The book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya Hakakian is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Data privacy, hacking, ransomware, and data theft have become devastating problems for businesses and individuals. Globex Data has the solution. Switzerland has the world's strictest data privacy laws, and Globex Data's Swiss-hosted secure application, spelled S-E-K-U-R, uses a proprietary technology outside of big tech, which means your data remains private and secure. Globex Data just signed two telecom giants to distribute its secure communication solution to over 400 million people in 30 Latin American and Asian countries. Secure is the solution for messaging and email privacy with no data or phone number mining. Secure users can message non-secure users in full privacy and security using chat by invites. Globex Data is now available in the U.S., bringing messaging and email privacy and security to all Americans. This Data Privacy Minute has been brought to you by Globex Data Limited. Stock trading symbol SWISF. Web address globexdata.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.